couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movie, Insidious: The Last Key. And since it's the only movie opening this week, I'm also going to be covering some other releases that I haven't talked about yet, like Bright on Netflix, Loving Vincent, and The Big Sick. I'm also going to be talking about those are ones that have sort of got lost in the shuffle during award season. I also want to talk about the news, Trailer Park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring the 2017 Doctor Who Christmas special, Twice Upon a Time. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to talk about is a quick shout-out to the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. That is on January 11th, 2018, which is next Thursday. And that is going to be airing on the CW with Olivia Munn as the host. So you can check that out and see if me as a voting member had any influence in the final tallies. I don't even know who's going to win. I have yet to vote for the final in the ballot. You've heard me talk all year about these movies. You've heard me talk through award season. Find out who wins on January 11th on the CW at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. The next piece of news really isn't news. I remember reading this tweet. Somebody had pointed out that Neil deGrasse Tyson said, there's no cosmic significance to January 1st in the calendar, even going back to its development. It's just an arbitrary date. But it is a date that makes you kind of stop things, look back, and plan ahead. Now, it's been a kind of a weird year for me, but this is a great time to look back. And one of the things I did this week was, as I was waking up, I was flipping through Facebook on my phone, and I fell down a rabbit hole, which is easy to do on the internet. And the rabbit hole was about the Flat Earth Society. There's a huge Flat Earther Facebook page that has, I don't even know how many people it has. I didn't even look that closely at it. But I just started reading the posts in the comments, fascinated that there are people out there who refuse to believe that the Earth is round, who refuse to believe that we're a planet circling a sun, who refuse to believe the whole of NASA's scientific knowledge, who refuse to believe pretty much everything from Galileo on, in terms of astronomical science. And it blows my mind because it's very easy to prove the Earth is round. I was on a cruise ship over Christmas. And if you go out on the cruise ship, if you go out like to the side, the port or the starboard side, and you look out in the open ocean, you can see from horizon to horizon the curvature of the Earth. The ocean is that flat that you can actually see the curvature of the Earth. I've also on a cruise ship watched as something kind of cracks over the horizon. I occasionally sail to Nassau. You sail in and you can see the famous lighthouse popping up over the horizon, not appearing off in the distance, but actually coming over the horizon. Those are very basic truths of a curvature of the Earth. Forget all the science and the decades of research. This is stuff that I've empirically watched with my own eye. And there are people out there who believe it. And then you start reading their posts and they go into this deep discussion of science and you should do research. Well, really, they don't want you to do research by like going to school or talking to a scientist or reading a book. They just want you to watch more crazy YouTube videos. And if there are people out there who can believe crazy YouTube videos about the flat Earth, you can believe anything. Now, how does that relate to movies? When it comes to movies and when it comes to like film Twitter, it's a microcosm of the greater world. The thing is, in film Twitter, with the exception of some things like all the accusations going on, which can actually do damage to people, and the stuff that goes on and the theories and the ideas and the craziness on film Twitter, it's nonsense and it doesn't mean one thing one way or the other. It doesn't impact real life. I mean, if somebody has a crazy fan theory about how Jar Jar Binks fits into the new Star Wars movies, that doesn't impact the world. But these things show up. And the point is, these are scintillating stories. These are things that make you think beyond something. People want to be creative. People want to be a part of something significant. And so when they read something like Jar Jar Binks becoming Snoke, that appeals to them because they go, oh, well, now I know something more. And there's greater meaning to this stupid character that was barely in three movies in the 90s and early 2000s. But you push that outside of film Twitter and you get some crazy stuff going on, like Flat Earth Society. And if you read their discussions of it, it's insane. So the whole point is, as I'm saying, go to the Flat Earth Society's page on Facebook and marvel at the stupidity that's going on and the banging your head against the wall to create this weird picture of the Earth that is physically impossible, where gravity doesn't exist, just to explain your own bullheaded theories. And then you'll understand why crazy things happen outside of film Twitter and why we do have to be a little more critical in our thinking. So that's my plea. Be more critical in your thinking, not just in think pieces about Jar Jar Binks, but in think pieces about anything from politics to society. Let's use critical thinking rather than knee-jerk, emotional, crazy thinking that goes on in social media. That's my plea for the new year. And another thing I did on the new year is I went to a video store. There's still a video store down the road from where I live. It's called Video Central. It's in Columbus, Ohio. Privately owned. Great little store. It's not huge. It's a small little store. But what's great about it, it's lived past all the Blockbusters. But you know what's great about that place? They have this massive cult section. Bizarre, strange movies you're never going to find on Redbox. You might be able to find them cycling through on Amazon, but Netflix doesn't care about cult movies. It's certainly not cult movies that are more than 5 or 6 years old. So a plea also in the new year, find a video store, patronize it, work with the people there because they're doing it as a labor of love. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Truth or Dare. No, not the Madonna movie from the 90s, but this horror film, which opens on April 27th.
Carter.
Truth.
What are your intentions with our sweet Olivia?
I needed to find someone with friends that I could trick into coming here. I brought you all up here because I'm okay with strangers dying if it means I get to live.
Something really weird has been going on ever since Mexico. Truth or dare?
Dare.
I know it sounds insane.
Just a little.
Carter said, tell the truth or you die. Do the dare or you die.
This is a Blumhouse movie, and they're actually now putting Blumhouse's name atop the title. So it's Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. I don't know if that has anything to do with the Madonna Truth or Dare movie, if they needed to differentiate it at all. Sort of like how they had Lee Daniels, the butler. That may be the reason they did that. But it also shows that Blumhouse is building a brand. And one of the things that Blumhouse does is it finds waves of popularity and rides them. It did that with the found footage angle, and they made some terrible movies. Well, after Happy Death Day did quite well in October, I think Blumhouse is really getting behind sort of gimmicky horror movies, which is great because I love gimmicky slasher movies. This looks like something that's going to be fun, that goes back to the old April Fool's Day type movies that I grew up with in the 80s. And this one, it looks like it could be a lot of fun and interesting. And I enjoyed Happy Death Day. I'm looking forward to more like this. The next one I want to talk about is Slender Man, which opens on May 18th.
Where is my daughter? People don't just disappear.
He gets in your head. Like a virus.
This one is equally gimmicky, but it's very different. I mean, ultimately, the trailer sounds really bonkers. The trailer itself plays like the video in The Ring. It's a lot of random shots and crazy looking things. So you get no sense of story. But I've always loved the idea of the Slender Man. And I think it's a creepy, modern, urban legend, myth type thing. So I'm looking forward to that one too. It might be a good year for mainstream horror movies. You may not have to deep dive into video on demand for these. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be revisiting Loving Vincent and The Big Sick. We'll be right back. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. When I said I'm going to be covering The Big Sick, I'm not talking about my throat. My apologies to out there in radio land. You might hear a little bit of raspiness, some Demi Moore sexiness going on with me. I went on a cruise right before Christmas. The whole family took a cruise. We're on the biggest ship in the... Well, not the biggest ship. I found out the ship that we were on is like 2.5 inches smaller than the largest ship on the planet. I believe it's the Allure of the Seas, which is the largest one. We are on the Oasis of the Seas, which literally is like 2.5 inches smaller. It's essentially the same ship. Massive boat. We had a great time with the family. But one of the things you do leading up to it, you don't want to get sick for a cruise, because that's not something you can easily replicate. You can't just postpone it for a week. So I held off being sick, got home. My son got sick immediately after we got back, which is fine because at least he didn't get sick before the cruise. And then he gave me the cold. So now you've got my sexy, throaty Demi Moore voice whispering in your ears. Anyways, let's talk about Loving Vincent. This is actually a movie that was recommended to me months ago. And I watched it months ago. I just never got around to reviewing it because, as you remember, in November and December, there were like 50 billion movies opening. I mean, just pump the brakes, people. But anyways, I want to thank the listener for recommending Loving Vincent. I did get around to watching it, and it is one that's significant to talk about, mainly because it's getting a little bit of awards buzz. You're seeing it nominated for some animated films. So let's talk a little bit about that. A man investigates the suicide of Vincent van Gogh, told in the animation style of the famous painter.
Vincent van Gogh killed himself?
How does a man go from calm to suicidal in 6 weeks?
So, what brings you to Auvers?
I want to do something for Vincent.
You're not going to stir things up again, are you? You've had quite enough weeping over that nutcase.
Vincent, what have you done?
We all knew something was very wrong.
Vincent!
Now, the style of the movie is as important as anything else, because it's a fascinating look at animation. One of the things I love about animation is that there are many different ways to do it. Most people think animated movie and you think one of two things. You either think cell animation, like the classic Snow White, Cinderella, you know, ink and paint style that Disney had, or you think CGI, which is Pixar, DreamWorks, all that stuff that most movies that are animated are. But there's a lot of other artistic forms of it. There's stop motion, which, of course, Leica does brilliantly. But also, the stop-motion type of animation is done by Wes Anderson. He's coming up with Isle of Dogs this year, and he did Fantastic Mr. Fox several years ago. So animation style is very different. And the way this style is done, it's oil-painted. It's kind of rotoscope, but rotoscoping is like a technical term where you animate over something. But no, this is oil painted. They actually are painting the imagery, and they're doing frames of oil painting and changing. And it gives a really interesting look because it's like living inside a Van Gogh painting. And that's what's so beautiful about it. And that's what the artistry that goes into this. The other thing that's interesting about it, well, it tells an interesting story, and it's the Citizen Kane version of the death of Vincent Van Gogh. It shows the historical, like, day-to-day life around it. Van Gogh is so well-known and so revered and so iconicized that people forget that he was just a guy potting around this area of France, painting pictures of people in the neighborhood and scenes out his window. And these very famous paintings, these iconic images that we now know are his paintings, were just his surroundings, and it was his style that brought it to life. It's a gorgeous movie to watch. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It comes out, I think, on Blu-ray and DVD next week. So I'm going to have to say that Loving Vincent rocks. It's totally worth checking out.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next movie, which is The Big Sick. This one came out, I believe, this summer. And it was one of those movies that was really kind of impossible for me to review, because it was a small enough release that it got a limited run. So the way things work is studios will screen movies early for, like, bigger movies. You know, like Star Wars was screened early for us. Jumanji was screened early for us. This movie wasn't big enough to screen widely, and it opened in this rock and roll coming from town to town, there was really no solid release date. It was sort of just this mushy release date in various places over the course of like a month or two. It was also too early in the year to really get award consideration. So while it was campaigned and pushed near the end of the year, there were no real attempts to show it to critic organizations because it was like July. Now, I eventually got a screener and I watched it. But by the time it opened in my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, it had kind of made its way through the main reviews. And so it was, you know, and I didn't know when it was going to open because this radio show is on nationally. And you can hear it almost all over this country. So it was very hard to nail down when to review it. So that's why I didn't review it before now. But I think it's worth talking about because it is picking up some awards, as expected. After breaking up with his girlfriend, a comedian is called to the hospital for her when she is put into a medically induced coma.
Can you imagine a world in which we end up together?
I don't know. I'm looking for Emily Gardner. She was checked in tonight.
There's an infection. We put her in a medically induced coma.
Coma.
You should call her family.
Thank you, Kamala. We're going to handle things from here.
I think I'm just going to wait anyway.
You guys broke up. I'm not sure why you're here.
I'm just going to stay for a second. Is that lady still looking at me?
Now, this movie is the true story of comedian Kamal Nanjiani. I think I'm saying his name right. Who ended up marrying the character that's his wife. It's how they met. Quite literally, it's this bizarre thing that happened. They dated, broke up, and he was kind of called in as her significant other at the hospital. And then eventually her family shows up because they're from out of town. And it's how they got to know each other. But the character played by Zoe Kazan, she's in a coma most of the movie, so you don't actually hear from her. But it's really him bonding with the family. And that's the stuff I really liked. When you finally get to the point where his character bonds with the family, I think that that's very sweet. And it shows how people can come together who otherwise wouldn't. And it also shows how he bonds with the family while nothing goes on with him and her because she's in a coma. Now, part of the problem is casting Zoe Kazan. She's got such a history of playing that manic pixie dream girl. It's really hard for her to bust out of that. Now, I imagine she's very similar to his wife, who it's based on, but she is kind of playing totally into type. My other problem is that Kamal is he's the kind of a depressing person, which is not uncommon with comedians. Comedians are depressing people who hate themselves, which is usually what makes them good comedians. Now, there's parts of it that are very sweet, but there's also parts of it that I found very abrasive and unappealing. But in terms of the romance, people talk, oh, it's this great romantic comedy. I had a conversation with my wife. She's a huge fan of romantic comedies. Romantic comedies as a genre are like the Reese Witherspoons, Julia Roberts, romantic comedies of the 90s. This is a comedy and it has a romance element to it. I would never define this as a romantic comedy. It's not a rom-com. But it's the kind of movie that a lot of people can be like, safely say, oh, I don't like romantic comedy, but I like this. It's kind of like Sideways, which is a romance and a comedy, but it's not a romantic comedy. But people are like, oh, but I like that. I don't like regular romantic comedies, but I like this one. It's worth seeing, but I think the hype is a little too big for it. Still, I'm going to say The Big Sick kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Insidious, The Last Key. And Bright.
And the Magnificent!
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We are leading into the movie reviews. Finally, I'm going to talk about the one new movie that is out this week. And there's only one film, even in limited release. I'm sure there's stuff expanding and contracting, you know, like the ebb and flow of the universe. But all we've got for new movies this week is Insidious, The Last Key. A paranormal investigator searches for a way to contain a demon she, whoops, inadvertently released years ago.
People who need help with matters that can't be explained come to me. These hauntings can be terrifying things. I should know. I have faced many evils in my life. This was different, though. the haunted house is my family's house.
Now, it is not uncommon for there to be only one release on the first weekend of the year. It's also not uncommon for it to be a horror movie. The one thing that's normally happens is they're terrible horror movies, like really bad horror movies. Remember that movie Devil's Due? The one, it was a found footage movie about a girl got pregnant on some vacation by the devil. And there was another one called The Devil Inside. Of course, there, I'll see the theme here. The Devil Inside was this really terribly put together found footage movie that made a ridiculous amount of money. Also, you got Insidious is a series that it's up to number 4. And usually by the time you get to number 4 in any series, it's usually, you know, circling the drain at this point. Now, the Insidious movies have kind of had kind of an interesting route. I loved Insidious, the first one. James Wan kind of redefined modern horror, which is great because we are languishing under the awfulness of found footage. And then Insidious 2 was interesting, and I appreciated what they did. I don't think they quite stuck the landing, but it was still a respectable movie. The third Insidious came out a year or two ago, and that one just was incredibly forgettable. I believe it was an August release, just disappeared into the wind. Now, I mean, the Insidious 2 was a September release, but it released on Friday the 13th, which gave it a little bit of notoriety. I was really waiting for this one to just suck hard. But what's interesting is sometimes I'm surprised. Part of it is this is based on the character of Elise. And if you remember her from the other movie, she was the older woman who was the paranormal investigator, played by Lynn Shea. And she has her team of Specs and Tucker who are there helping her out. And this is sort of a prequel with her. It just takes place before the first movie. It's not like necessarily setting everything up. But the character of Elise is a very charming, wonderful character that Lynn Shea really kind of brought to life and was one of those great secondary characters in a movie. And I thought she was fantastic in the other movies. I think she's great in this one. She's seen a sudden resurgence. The actress has seen a sudden resurgence in popularity because she's done this and she's done a couple other horror movies, which is great. I love seeing an actor or an actress get a bump after just a career of playing kind of character roles. And you saw that with Tobin Bell with the Jigsaw character. He just was a character actor. Probably his biggest claim to fame before he did Jigsaw was he was the albino assassin in The Firm. Nobody cared who he was, but suddenly got this notoriety doing this franchise and he embraced it. And so has Lynn Shea. And she really kind of brings a charm and warmth to it. And I could watch a whole series of just her ghost busting, which I'm thinking is what the plan is. I also think it's amazing that the first and only big release of this week is a franchise film starring a 74-year-old woman. You don't see that all that often. You're usually expecting some young, big celebrity. But I think that's great. This movie has, you know, a lot of the elements that you'd expect from the other film. It has her going into the further. So one of the things these Insidious movies do spend a lot of time outside of our normal realm. They spend time in sort of this shadow realm that she goes into. We saw that in Insidious. And like Insidious, both the Insidious first film and Insidious 2, I'd say the last act goes almost completely in what they call the further, which is this ghostly realm. And they managed to make it work. And it's not that they don't make it work here. It's not as strong of a story as the original Insidious, but as just sort of a one-off ghost-busting story, I enjoyed it. I thought it has some pacing issues, yeah. And there are moments where I think they spend a little too much time in the further, in the background, in this ghostly world, that it almost normalizes it. It's a neat little character that we all kind of know and love, horror movie fans know and love her, and she gets her own series, and I think that's wonderful. So I'm going to have to say, surprisingly, Insidious the Last Key kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the film Bright. This has been released on Netflix for a couple weeks. It came out, or it hit the service, on the 22nd, right before Christmas. What's funny, I actually requested from Netflix. I have a Netflix rep, and I requested a screener of this. Never got it. And then after seeing it, well, let's wait for the review. A human and an orc work to save an elf in danger in this gritty cop drama with fantasy elements.
Everybody's just trying to get along and have a good life. All of the races are different. Just because they're different doesn't mean anybody's better or worse than anybody.
Hey, where's the diversity hire?
I got a dude in my car. I didn't ask for it, but the whole world is watching.
That's a magic wand. This is like a nuclear weapon that grants wishes.
That's whatever you want.
You're not stealing that wand.
The biggest notoriety that this movie has is the people working for it. It's got Will Smith in his first non-theatrical release. And it's got Joel Edgerton playing the orc. It's directed by David Ayer, who did Suicide Squad and End of Watch and Fury. So it's got a lot of names to it. And even like some of the secondary leagues, they got Edgar Ramirez. I don't know why he still gets parts, but he's in it as an elf. You've got Noomi Rapace in there, and I think she's great. This film is written by Max Landis, and it's been taking a lot of criticism for him because he's got this sexual misconduct story enveloping him right now. But it's really not his movie as much as it is David Ayer's, who directed it and apparently rewrote the script. But the basic gist of it is the world did exist with a Middle Earth type of races. You had orcs, they have fairies, they have elves, and they have humans. But it's sort of them living in our daily lives, and they've been around for thousands of years. From the premise of the movie, I have problems with it because it doesn't show an evolution of elf society or orc society. It's just saying, oh, we have the exact same evolution of society. It's just orcs are the black people and elves are the rich people. They're just transplanting it, but there's no actual thought that goes deeper than the very image. To the point that there's a scene where Will Smith references Shrek. And I'm like, you wouldn't have gotten a movie like Shrek in this world because fantasy element would have affected popular culture. But it's almost like you just snap your fingers and orcs appear. It's really ham-fisted. It doesn't work as a piece of speculative fiction because it's just a completely transparent placing of a type of race from a fantasy into a sect of society. It's just, it's not creative in that way. David Ayers makes it overly grim and dark, and even the good guys, even the good character of Will Smith is kind of a jerk and kind of an a-hole, and I'm not really rooting for him anyways. The only thing that makes him likable is just the general likableness of Will Smith. He kind of plays as not a good guy. The best part of this movie is Joel Edgerton as the orc. He actually brings some pathos, some levity, some humor. I just watched an entire movie about him, but then the racial allegory is so tone deaf and stupid and not original and not subtle. I didn't care what was going on, and they're chasing this magic wand. Then they violate their own ideas, and of course they have a corny, stupid ending that you can see coming a mile away. But the thing is, it got watched a lot through Netflix, so they greenlit a sequel with Will Smith and Joel Edgerton and David Ayer attached, which is great because keep him out of the DC universe. So that's it. Bright is not good, but a lot of people watched it, and that's how. That's why it's a success, but it still sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about my most anticipated films of 2018 and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Doctor Who, Twice Upon a Time. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with some housekeeping in terms of what's coming up in 2018. My most anticipated films of the year. Now, the first one that I would say the one I'm looking forward to most.
Hi. Well, as we wrap up production, I just want to take this moment to thank an incredibly talented cast and crew for all their hard work. And to the fans out there, I hope you've enjoyed the pictures that I've been sharing, pictures that I've taken from the set of... Can we even say the name of the movie? I'll see you next year.
Solo, A Star Wars Story. And not just because I'm a Star Wars nerd, but yes, because I'm a Star Wars nerd. But I was really intrigued with what they did with Rogue One. Because they weren't expanding it to a new universe. They were working within the confines of the established universe. And so there's certain things you can't affect. You can't kill Darth Vader in this movie. You can't have Han Solo run into Darth Vader or Anakin Skywalker and kill him. You just can't do that because he's got to be in the other movie. So they are constrained with what they can do in terms of sort of a prequel setting. But it's also giving backstory. And this is what essentially I always was looking forward to when Disney got Star Wars, is you get to enrich the characters, you enrich the universe, you enrich their backstory. You saw that with the books, with the comic books, with the role-playing games. That's what really made Star Wars a rich environment. That's what I think kept Star Wars popularity, not just the movies. Yes, the movies are great. But what kept it going in the 90s and into the 2000s, even under the shadow of the prequels, but leading up to it, was the fact that it extended and expanded into this universe that fans could completely play in. And while this is constrained to Han Solo's life, I'm looking forward to this. Plus, I'm looking forward to Ron Howard as a director. I'm curious to see what he does. And I'm very much into the spinoff and nostalgia aspect we got with Rogue One. The next anticipated stuff I have is the Marvel three punch. You've got Black Panther coming out in February. And this looks interesting because it looks wholly different from any other movie that the Marvel Universe has done. Now, after Guardians of the Galaxy proved that you can go completely out of the box, they can do stories that are not your typical superhero boring character arc or origin story. You can give a more unique story of Black Panther. That's what makes Black Panther doable now. If you would have gone out of the gate with Black Panther in 2010, people really wouldn't have been able to wrap their mind around it. Heck, people had a hard time wrapping their mind around Thor. They couldn't have gotten Black Panther with the connections they have here. But it looks like it's going to be a neat movie, and that's going to lead right into Infinity War in May, which is going to be a fantastically huge, significant Marvel movie. And then, of course, not to be outdone, they're going to have an Ant-Man movie, Ant-Man and the Wasp, coming up in July, basically bookending your Infinity War. And it's going to show that they're going to continue into another phase of the Marvel Universe. And I think that that's great. I love that they're really thinking outside of the box and everybody's up to speed on them. So those I'm very much looking forward to. Now, in terms of other big movies that I think have anticipation for them, I'm real curious to see A Wrinkle in Time. I want to see Ava DuVernay, who I think is a very talented director, do something different than what she's done. No documentaries, no biopics, doing something that's a book adaptation. And I remember reading it as a kid. I want to see, you know, a Disney version of this movie. I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg playing in his known nostalgia sandbox. Looks like it's going to be kind of fun. I trust Spielberg at this point. He gave us a fantastic movie, The Post, and he's going to be doing his more box office leaning movie. Hopefully it'll be a lot better than BFG. Mission Impossible 6 is another one I'm looking forward to. That comes out this summer because the Mission Impossible series has gotten better as time goes on. I do think it peaked at 4, you know, the Ghost Protocol, but I still thought that the next movie was good as well. That they've really kind of found a niche, and another new Mission Impossible movie. It's one of the best things that Tom Cruise does now. There's also Aquaman at Christmas. I think DC is trying to recover from a less than stellar box office for Justice League and trying to separate, you know, when Wonder Woman's your greatest hit, you know, see, do something a little bit different. So I'll be curious to see what Aquaman turns into at Christmas. Other ones I'm also keeping on my radar include Rampage, Deadpool 2, and Jurassic Park, Fallen Kingdom, although I'm not quite sold on any of them just yet. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's look a little bit at last week's box office over the four-day weekend, if you count January 1st. Star Wars made almost $67 million, was right behind it was Jumanji. Jumanji actually has been doing better throughout the week than Star Wars has. So I don't know. I don't know which one's going to win. I don't think Insidious is... I mean, it's possible Insidious could make $40 million. Weirder things have happened. But I really think that Star Wars and Jumanji are going to be duking it out this weekend. It's a robust time for movies. You got plenty of movies that have already opened that you probably have already missed. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the Home Cinema Roundup. The movie I want to talk about for the Home Cinema Roundup isn't really a movie. It is the Doctor Who holiday special. They do a Christmas special every year for Doctor Who ever since they rebooted the franchise back in 2005. And this was not only this year's holiday special, the Christmas special, but it was also the farewell of Peter Capaldi. And of course, we get the new Doctor at the very end, Jodie Whittaker. You see it right at the very, very, very end, which is great because I'm looking forward to see where they go with this character. Wholly different from anything else. But you get one more round with Peter Capaldi, and that is in the film Doctor Who, Twice Upon a Time. The 12th Doctor refuses to regenerate and finds himself at the South Pole with a previous version of himself.
I'm the Doctor.
I am the Doctor.
Something has gone very wrong with time. We're trapped inside a single moment.
So sorry. I don't suppose either of you is a doctor.
You're trying to be funny. We do have one little advantage.
What advantage?
There's two of us.
One of the most significant elements to this one is that they've brought back the first Doctor. Now, not the original actor, because William Hartnell died 50 years ago or something. But they've got David Bradley, who played, I think he played him in the Day of the Doctor. He's best known for playing Filch, the caretaker in the Harry Potter movies, you know, the one with the cat. But he does a great job as the original Doctor. And with two old guys kind of working with each other, I've always loved the Doctor crossovers. I always love when the Doctor meets himself. Now, they've done those, you know, gosh, ever since, I think they did the two Doctors. I know they did the three Doctors when the third Doctor, John Pertwee, was there. They had the three of them. And I know they had another one with Tom Baker. And so they've done like the five Doctors. And I loved when they did the 50th anniversary special. You had David Tennant and Matt Smith meeting each other, also with the War Doctor played by John Hurt. Rest in peace. So it's nice to see them playing in their universe that's been built for 50 plus years. And this one is a little bit more of an intimate story because it's basically about the Doctor dealing with himself, not wanting to regenerate, whether he should go on to death or whether he should continue. We all know he's going to continue because we got Jodie Whittaker waiting in the wings, but she's a much younger character. Much younger Doctor, so we'll see what she does. But overall, I think this is neat. It ties up a couple ends in there, and you see some cameos from characters and actors from older ones. This one, of course, aired on Christmas Day. It was on the BBC. You're going to see it come out on DVD and Blu-ray very, very soon. So overall, when it comes to the Doctor Who Christmas special, Twice Upon a Time, I'm going to have to say I kind of rocked. It wasn't the best. It wasn't the best of the multiple Doctors, but I enjoyed it.
It kind of rocks.
Other movies that are coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, we've got American Made, which is Tom Cruise in his lesser interesting roles, like not a Mission Impossible movie. Battle of the Sexes, which is quite good, and I would have loved to have seen that get better traction during award season. But comedies are difficult. Comedies are very difficult to nail. And what you end up with is you end up with a movie that people don't think is as significant as it should be. But I think both Emma Stone and Steve Carell were fantastic in the movie. And it's a weirdly feel-good film. There's also Breathe, which was not nearly as good as it could have been. I mean, chalk that up to first-time directing problems with Andy Serkis. And then finally, Brad's Status, which stars Ben Stiller in a movie that kind of flew completely under the radar and apparently supposed to be quite good. I haven't watched it yet, so I have failed as a film critic. Anyways, that is it for the week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Commuter, The Post, and Proud Mary. Remember to watch the Critics' Choice Movie Awards on January 11th at 8 o'clock on the CW. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.